mean, Frank Lloyd Wright, for example, loved to have control of everything, of the outdoor space, the landscaping. He did not want his clients to bring grandma's rocker into the new house because it just wouldn't do well in the drawings and the photographs.
Architects can be a controlling bunch. It's little wonder then that many of the industry's best known names have flirted with the idea of expanding into furniture design, casual encounters that, in some cases, became lustful affairs. We'll visit an exhibition dedicated to architects and furniture today on Section D. This is Section D, Monocle's weekly design show. I'm Ben Rylan. Also today...
One of the most important points at Mooch Hotel is to provide atmosphere and environment so that you can have a very sound sleep, like you feel at home.
We'll check in for some pared back pampering at the world's first Muji Hotel. And...
The last 6 years have gone very fast forward. We have opened up with our own salespeople here, our own people in the market. That has helped a lot.
Monocle's Stockholm correspondent takes us on a tour of Carl Hansen & Son's brand new furniture flagship in the Swedish capital. That's ahead on Section D. We may be barely into February, but if you're already itching for an early year break, you might want to consider the Chinese city of Shenzhen. The world's first hotel, operated by the retail brand Muji, is officially open for business. And with at least two more locations coming soon, the company is well on the way to transforming itself into a global lifestyle company. We sat down with the president of Muji's parent company, Satoru Matsuzaki, who we'll hear from now via his translator.
As an important point of the, how to say, hotel, and the hotel's definition, much like understand is like, is to provide like, how to say, home house-like like atmosphere, but to make also make profit. So very important things, you know, 24 hours a day, 365 days, and provide the good atmosphere like at home. Then how to say, to this is a very important point. So this is the. As I say, to realize the Muji Hotel concept is most important point. So at the Muji Hotel, it's very important to what kind of services we provide or not. Then, as from the standpoint of the, like you feel at home, the most important thing is to have a sound sleep. So then, one of the most important points at the Muji Hotel is to provide atmosphere and environment so that you can have a very sound sleep, like you feel at home.
When it comes to the details of what makes a good hotel, we probably all have our own set list of priorities. A comfy bed, a refreshing shower, tasteful decor. As a brand, Muji is better placed than most to cover all those areas. But how would Satoru Matsuzaki describe a good hotel? For him, it's all about focusing on the essentials. In a word, sleep.
So Mr. Matsuzaki himself, he's like a very like a Muji. He's like a Muji. Then also he works for the retail other business, but he doesn't want to have anything necessary thing. So he just want to have the other say minimum thing. So then also as the other say hotel, a very important thing is to other say all the sleeping as he said. Then one thing that for Mr. Matsuzaki different other people, only 3 hours or 4 hours of sleep, 4 hours per day sleep is enough. And also if he had a chance, even 5 minutes, he wants to other say quick sleep. So most important thing in such a short time period, he can have a very sound deep sleep. So that's the for him good hotel is the hotel which you provide the atmosphere room which you can have a very sound deep sleep.
For now, Shenzhen is the only city boasting a Muji hotel, but plans for additional locations in Beijing and Tokyo are quickly falling into place. But Satoru Matsuzaki is careful not to get too ahead of himself. For now, it's all about establishing the Muji standard.
At this point, like, I would like to focus on this for the also Beijing and Ginza. of the three hotels which have decided. And because to have the Muji Hotel, very important is the things to have the very good partner. At the same time, also, I think we're still in the process to realize the best Muji Hotel and in the, during such a process, because there's many things in detail we want to improve further. So meanwhile, we want to focus to, as I said, make this Shenzhen Hotel, good to the hotels perfect, and also to, as I said, work hard on the rest two hotels. Then, of course, this is the kind of business. So if we have a good partner or, as I said, potential premises, of course, we have a consideration. But at this point, Mr. Matsuki thinks very, very important for us to focus to make this project and the next two projects is the best. So I believe by establishing maybe three these hotels, like Shenzhen, Beijing, Ginza, we're going to provide us a kind of the good standardization of the Muji Hotel. Only one hotel, maybe not enough. So the focusing on these three hotels to establish the Muji Hotel standard is very important at this point.
The other locations are still in the early planning stages, but what about that Muji standard, and how will this pilot project inform the design of future openings?
Even Beijing or even Ginza will be a similar size of this hotel, because we think we'd better to focus on this kind of size hotel. So I don't think we're going to have the bigger hotel meanwhile. So it's very important to provide a good experience for our guests. So that's the, for us, it's not good for us to, I don't think we're going to set a goal for the number of the rooms whatsoever.
So
I think the realization of the what our concept, anti-gorgeous, anti-cheap, and the providing throughout the whole hotel experience services to be fulfilled, that is a stage we think we make the kind of very Muji, perfect Muji hotel. I think that the best Muji hotel would be the for the guest if they find, oh, that's what's very Muji, so they feel that's the most important thing. Yeah. So often, even for the Muji product, as I say, people feel like a Mujiness. Yeah, like ambience or environment, as I say, atmosphere. So if for the hotel, I believe I want to realize that's kind of, oh, that's very Muji ambience, Muji feelings.
For some brands, the transformation of an aesthetic into an adjective is perhaps the highest honor. And by instilling everything in their brand palette inside the carefully controlled environment of a hotel, Muji may indeed achieve just that. How this exercise in luxury simplicity is received in the longer term remains to be seen, but there's no doubting that, on the international stage, Muji is no longer a mere purveyor of handsome stationery and minimalist wardrobe essentials. Muji is a lifestyle. Our thanks to Kurt Lin for that report. Still to come, we'll visit the furniture design brand Carl Hansen and Son's new flagship store in Stockholm. But first, a look at another important event happening in the Swedish capital this week. Now in its 16th year, Stockholm Design Week is arguably the most important event on the Scandinavian design calendar. Among the highlights is the first lighting collection by design firm Snohetta, a wooden series that was initially created for Sweden's Tree Hotel. The Flick Flack collection features a wall-mounted lamp, a table lamp, and a floor lamp. We'll have more from Stockholm Design Week coming up on next week's show. Elsewhere this week, Monocle heard from the founder of design firm HEM, Petrus Palmer. He told us why it's important for Scandinavian brands to also consider themselves international brands.
I mean, we're a Swedish company and I'm a Swedish designer originally. So of course there is a lot of design heritage from being Scandinavian and being Swedish. But I'm not sure it's interesting in this day and age with nationality. And especially since the design audience and people that really care about quality and unique items, they're not necessarily, you know, linked geographically. It's more mindset. So our approach has always been to find the most interesting designers out there and work with them.
To hear that full interview, listen back to Monday's edition of the Monocle Daily. The Section D mailbag is always open to queries and suggestions. Get in touch by emailing me, Ben Ryland, on br@monocle.com. This is Section D. Stay tuned. We're staying in Stockholm now, where Carl Hansen & Son, the iconic Danish furniture maker founded in 1908, recently opened a brand new flagship store as part of its ongoing expansion. Our correspondent, Elna Nakanen Andersen, visited the shop and sat down with the founder's grandson and current CEO, Knud Hansen.
It is very often so that those things that can happen right in front of you always takes a long time to realize or to organize. And from our point of view, Sweden has been a market where we have developed slowly, but the last 6 years have gone very fast forward. We have opened up with our own salespeople here, our own people in the market. That has helped a lot. So today, Carl Hansen & Son has its own salespeople all over the world. I think we have 2 agents left. Otherwise, we only sell through our own sales offices. And that has helped a lot because you have 100% concentration of the company's products and the stories and the way it's presented and things like that. And Sweden now is an area where we want to show our furniture in the way we like them to stay and to be, and also to give people an opportunity to come in and see how it all matches. It doesn't matter whether it is a young architect that has produced furniture for Carl Hansen or it is right back to Kåre Klint. The furniture can be standing together. They don't scream at each other or being the odd one out or anything like that. We try and keep a style and a design that makes it possible to furnish with Carl Hansen furniture all over and without having any difficulties. And that we can only show actually at our own stores.
And this is a strategy that you've had,
yes,
all over the world in,
yes,
the countries that you're in.
Yes, we have today, you can say it's a modest amount. We have 8 stores all over in the world, but in 2023 we would have around 25.
Okay, that's very fast growth.
So we try and push, and this year we have opened up 3 new stores, and next year will be 3 or 4 new stores. So we will carry on like this. Because it's also a matter of looking at what is happening in the market. You have a rapid development of web trade. And of course, we are not standing behind just looking at it. We are taking part of that as well. And for selling on the web, it is also interesting for our customers to be able to come in and see what they're actually buying if they can't. In major areas of the world, we will have areas, we will have stores or showrooms where people can come in and see it.
So those two go hand in hand,
they
the physical shop
hand.
And the online
presence. Yes, they do.
Presence.
They do. In many places, we are well branded and it's less necessary, but in areas where we are not as well known, it's also a must that we have a store. Mm. Perhaps a little smaller than here in Stockholm, but they will be there.
Mm. And you're very big, for instance, in Japan,
yes,
and in many other countries internationally.
Right.
And
yes,
it seems like, well, since you came on board, the company has been growing, and at the same time, there's been a huge interest in this mid-century Scandinavian furniture, and it shows no signs of, you know, stopping. What is the infatuation about? Why do people love this style of furniture so much?
I think they have always liked it. I don't think many people think that it is quite a kind of a trend that now the Danish design or the, perhaps even the Scandinavian design is in. I don't think it has been like that. I don't think it's a trend. I think it's coming to be permanently like this, but that is because we only kind of wake up now. It has been the biggest secret of the world that we actually existed. Denmark is a funny country, it's small, and it is a country where if the weather is nice, people don't move, they stay and look at, oh, the sun is up. It doesn't happen very often, but you know, you have a kind of a little laid-back culture, which we are now realizing that if you want to stay in business, you have to grow. You have to be there where things are happening.
So you have to go against
your
Danish nature.
Exactly. And therefore, at least from Carl Hansen's point of view, the last 15 years, we have developed tremendously. I think we are about 50 times bigger than we were in 2002.
Is that because you brought your business knowledge from shipping where you worked before to this company?
I don't come from the furniture trade. And therefore, It has been interesting to kind of convert what I learned in shipping, which is extremely competitive, to our furniture trade, where I can at least, as far as Carl Hansen Son is concerned, I can move. I do get competition, of course we do, but it's a different competition to what you get in shipping, where everything is alike. Here you have different products that you offer for the trade, and if you can see what people are actually going for, and if you can, if you really are engaged with the design and like it and live from it, you can also kind of see what has a future and what hasn't. And I think we have been very, let's just say, lucky there, because we have seem to have pressed the right buttons along the way.
Mm.
And we have many pieces of furniture today which is very attractive to people and that are selling well all over the world.
But you kind of, your history is quite interesting because you grew up with this, your
yes.
grandfather started the company,
correct.
But then you didn't want to work with this at first.
No.
What happened there?
I think a very typical thing which I think many people realize in too late in their life, and that is that we were two brothers that were earmarked to take over the business. And I realized in a very young age, by buying, my brother and I bought a sailing boat together, it turned out that we couldn't sail. We couldn't sail together. Individually, I think we are quite good at sailing. But as soon as you put us together in a small boat and tell us we are actually both captains, it doesn't work. And I didn't know myself from that part, and I don't think my brother either. We really had a big fight, really verbally, of course, but it was so that people ashore thought that we were drowning and they came out to rescue us, and we weren't.
We were in the boat having this fight.
I realized there, even I was only about 14 or 15 years old, that this year we will have to, I cannot work with him. And it turned out, I think he will also admit it, that he had a philosophy, he would not expand the company. He would not invest in new machinery and things like that. In fact, he wanted to run it, and when the day that it wouldn't run properly anymore, that it was worn out, he would just fold it up.
Close.
So he has no, let me say it straight out, he has no ambitions. Maybe I got all of that because I had a totally different philosophy. And therefore, I joined the largest company in Scandinavia at that time, the East Asiatic Company, and we were 40,000 people employed. So great competition internally to get to the top. And there you really learned how to work and how to position yourself and how to make business. And you were actually left to do it. So you were allowed to work your own way. And I was very fortunate. I was sent out to South Africa and I ended up in Port Elizabeth, where there was nobody else but me. And when I left, we were 18 people, and I was 23 years old when I got there. The people I employed were about double my age. It was no problem, and we had a fantastic time. I had it at least, and then I moved on to Singapore, where I joined the biggest shipping agency in Singapore. We were 380 people, and I was marketing manager there in an age of 27, 28 years. Great, great opportunity. And I ended up in Hong Kong just when Deng Xiaoping opened up his stores for China business, and we grew from 96 people to 800, and I became the managing director of the whole shipping in China and Hong Kong. So I had a fantastic life.
Mm.
And then I had a soft landing back in Europe. I went to Hamburg, and I was 4.5 years in Hamburg, and then we sold all our shipping activities to A.P. Moller, to Maersk. And then I was out of business, I nearly say. I had to leave
the
company.
Did you take some years off?
I didn't know.
No.
I became the managing director of Tempur-Pedic, which is a nice Swedish company at that time. They were Swedish owners. And I worked with Tempur-Pedic for 4.5 years, and I was told to sell the company. And I did that to GE Capital in the United States. And then I left the company because the Americans moved everything to USA except for the production. And I'm not a production person. So I thought it had to be run by professional engineers and production engineers and production people. So I chose to leave the company. Then I could have moved to the United States, but I didn't feel like it at that time. And then I went to my brother and I said to him, you buy my shares, and then I go back to the Far East and work there. I still have very good connections in Hong Kong. And he said, no way, you buy my shares and I retire.
Elna Nikonen Anderson there with Knut Hansen at Stockholm's new flagship edition of Carl Hansen & Son. Finally today, we're off to New York, where an exhibition is underway showcasing a range of furniture designed by architects. With over a century of works on display covering names such as Frank Gehry, Oscar Niemeyer, Charlotte Perriand, and Frank Lloyd Wright, it's a thorough look at how these two worlds of design can often blend seamlessly into one another. Its curator, Mark McDonald, has been obsessed with architectural furniture since his days as an apprentice at the legendary antiques dealer Lillian Nassau, a formative period that helped set off a lifetime love affair with design. He spoke to Monocle's Charles McFarlane.
A lot of the pieces that we are showing are pieces that were custom designed for specific commercial or institutional even, but then that could maybe have led to the production of that kind of thing by the architect in a more mass-produced kind of way. The classic example of that being the Eames, who designed pieces basically for mass production, but also Frank Lloyd Wright, who designed things that then were later put into some kind of production in terms of furniture for a manufacturer. So that's sort of the topic of the exhibition, is showing a lot of these very early incarnations of then what later became a more common kinds of things, but these were the first things, the things that were done for these specific clients by these architects, often using new materials, done in a different way because they had more freedom. They weren't really designing for mass production. They were designing for a client. Clients often giving these people free rein because they were doing the house and the furnishings from the ground up. So there's a lot of pieces from that as examples of that. So we're also showing a lot of photographs of the pieces in their original settings, in the houses that they were designed for. Then we're going all the way up into the 90s with Ettore Sottsass, who designed limited edition pieces of furniture that were not specifically commissions for a house, but for a manufacturer, but in a very limited sense.
You call on this idea of, I guess, unrestrained design or organic design as being, you don't have to sort of be fitting this into mass production. Is that part of the reason why you were attracted to architects' design?
I've always been interested in architecture. I mean, I always like plans. I like drawing plans. I was good at mechanical drawing. I like the spatial idea of what you can put down on a piece of paper and imagine what it would look like in terms of spaces. And as a professional, I started being interested in what filled those spaces. So that's part of the reason why we want to call it Inside the Walls, because we're talking about architecture, but we're talking about what filled up the architecture and not specifically about the architecture itself. So many of these architects really like to have, I mean, Frank Lloyd Wright, for example, loved to have control of everything, of the outdoor space, the landscaping. He did not want his clients to bring grandma's rocker into the new house because it just wouldn't do well in the drawings and the photographs. So those architects who have the liberty to be able to work with the client so that they don't have to be limited by the past or by tradition and can start from scratch often came up with really interesting things that then can also lead to production later, to mass production, but specifically they're working with a client who sort of gives them free rein, and then they imagine the house and what it looks like on the inside. That's what Frank Lloyd Wright called organic, when I always sort of felt like all it was a way for him to just say, you can't do what you want to do, I'm going to control it, and I'm going to control the way it looks once it's done. So, in fact, he would come to people's houses. He would drive back and forth across the country every year because he was in Arizona in the winter and he was in Wisconsin in the summer. And he would stop at his houses and he was known to rearrange the furniture when he came to see some client's house. Even though he'd been there living there for 10 years, he would go, oh, no, that doesn't go there. So he was a real control freak. But the idea of controlling the whole package was an interesting idea that architects have an advantage over someone who's just a decorator or a furniture designer who has to worry about the manufacturer, has to worry about the mass market, has to worry about salespeople or the showroom or how it's going to fit into a line of furniture. Architects didn't have to have that constraint, and they're able to be a little bit more free. And they also were able to take advantage of some of the newer techniques. I mean, war inventions or innovations like fiberglass or laminated plywood in the third dimension that the Eames then were able to make chairs out of. Those are things also that architects were able to take advantage of and are more willing to take risks when they only have the one client that they've got to satisfy.
Could you give some examples of pieces that are in the exhibit that were never mass produced that might be a little bit of a rarity to come see?
There's a lot of those. Almost all the Frank Lloyd Wright pieces are unique to a house. Often some of the graphics that we'll have at the show show those pieces in their original setting. There's a great Schindler modular chair and ottoman that was designed for a house in Los Angeles in the 30s called the Van Patten House that was an idea that Schindler wanted to try and develop as a production furniture, but it never happened for one reason or another, which was a ottoman shape that then the side table and the back would plug into a very interesting piece of furniture. There's a prototype chair by Warren Plattner, who ultimately did a line of furniture for Knoll. It's a wire chair that was just a complete one-off that was never put into production. Very similar to a Batoya wire chair that was done by Knoll, but with a much more fluid, beautiful flow of lines. There's a great desk by Louis Kahn, the Philadelphia architect who didn't design much furniture and only specifically for houses. Did a lot of built-ins, but we have an amazing desk that was done for a house in 1954, and we have the original drawing for that desk. And then there are other things of production, things like Frank Gehry cardboard pieces that were done strictly for production, but it's a nice mix.
When you went about sourcing some of these, do a lot of these come from your own collection? I know you sort of have a vast collection that's been your business.
Yes, I have a history of hoarding. Actually, I live with things that I love. It's part of the thing that I love about my business, that I'm able to take things home and live with them for a while. If I tire of them or I need money, I can sell them, but it's a kind of a constant flow. A lot of the Frank Lloyd Wright pieces are pieces that either I owned and have at home or that I had been putting together to do. I was thinking of doing an exhibition either at one of the major fairs or Design Miami or at Basel of just Frank Lloyd Wright, but decided that I wanted to expand that into more than just that limited scope. And when Mark asked me to curate the show, I thought, well, that's a perfect beginning and base to start with. And then sort of my love of Breuer and Rietveld and Aalto and all the other people who made really interesting furniture innovations, I thought it'd be fun to expand that scope. And this show that we're doing is not really a survey. For example, I love Aalto, but we weren't able to find a really great piece of Aalto that was an example that sort of held up in terms of being rare and unusual and great condition. So we don't have a piece of Aalto in the show. Sadly, he's not represented, but it was also a product of, when you say sourcing, you just don't go out and go, I'll take one of those and one of those and one of those. It's just kind of whatever comes up on the market, what you can find, what you might be able to borrow from a client, what you might be able to get from another dealer on consignment. There are a few things that we don't own in the show, but most of the things either I own or Mark and I own together or Mark owns at the gallery Friedman Benda owns. So it's interesting putting it together. Over a period of 18 months, we had our eyes out for things that would fit within the scope, and some very interesting things came up, like those Frank Lloyd Wright lamps, the four lamps that were from the Little House, just showed up at an auction in the Middle West last year, and we were able to get those. So it was an interesting process.
This might be a little tough, but do you have a favorite piece in the exhibit?
I have two favorites, and I hope that they don't sell. Everything is for sale in the show, by the way, but there is a coffee table di Zamba Giaponte that's a production piece, but not many were made, I don't think. It's a round table that's divided into squares with painted colors, and when you walk around the table, the squares are painted in different shades, and so that you get a whole different realm of color of the palette, from yellows to grays to blues to reds to orange to yellow, again, as you circle around the table. That's one of my favorite things. And then there's a side table from my house that is my favorite piece of Frank Lloyd Wright that I've owned. It was just a nightstand from a table that was done in the late 40s, a house called Broadmorgen, which was in South Carolina. That's just a real interesting cubistic kind of, it's almost just like a little building or a little postmodern building or something with these sort of interesting planes. Rietveld looking in a way, but beautiful original condition. Those are my two favorite things.
Mark McDonald speaking to Monocle's Charles McFarlane in New York. Inside the Walls, Architects Design runs until the 17th of February. Next week, we're back in Stockholm for the city's Design Week, and we'll sit down with the Italian architect and industrial designer Antonio Citero to hear about his upcoming Taipei Sky Tower and how the roots of its design all stem from bamboo shoots.
What does it mean to build something here? It's like a tree, you know, when the trees, you know, and then you have the root, and the root is it's part of this land. In reality, it's true and it is not true.
Section D was researched by Daphne Karnizes and edited by Christy Evans. I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.